Before reading aloud, please check if okay. Ooh. Oh, nice. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Someone left their water bottle on the cushion shelves at about 6:30 a.m. When it came back for your talk, it was gone. Can it please be returned? It's Checky brand steel with blue stripes and lid. So please return it. It was probably that fellow. Because when I was giving the talk, probably this teddy bear took it. I get scared and depressed when I found out about the murder, psychopaths and horrible crimes committed by such evil mind space. How to make sense of psychopaths who murder even some are cannibals? It's a weird question. Okay, well, everybody has a bad day every now and again. So now, number one, remember there is no such thing as a murderer, there is no such thing as a psychopath, there is no such thing as an evil mind. It's sometimes the mind does evil things, but the mind is never evil. It gets corrupted, you know, by greed, hatred and delusion. It just gets confused. And so a lot of times, these are cases where people, because they're not sort of encouraged in good ways, sometimes they lose it. And, maybe alcohol-driven, drug-driven. So, if you want to really sort of do something about this, let's see if we can somehow lessen the availability of such things as drugs and alcohol even. And look, everybody knows, I remember reading this a long time ago, but even recently, George W. Bush's war on drugs. And they had three goals: to lessen supply, lessen demand, minimize harm. And I think just about a year ago, they had a big conference, I think it was even in Mexico, and they looked at those three goals: lessen supply, there's more supply than ever. Lessen demand, there's more demand than ever. And the harm has not been minimized at all. It's more harmful than ever before. So the so-called war on drugs, everybody knows it's one big failure. But there's other ways of dealing with that. If you had the political will, and the political will comes from you guys who vote for these people in, the political will is very clear sort of what the solution should be. It should not be made illegal, because once it's illegal, then you get gangs and criminal groups getting in charge of it, making huge amounts of money. And that means that's why many people get burgled, because to pay off the drug debts and something like that. And so that's a huge amount of crime in most societies that are related to drugs. And so if it was legalized but controlled, and then instead of trying to stop people taking it because it's illegal, do what they've done in Australia with cigarette smoking, which is just making a huge amount of marketing to show that, anyone who takes a fag is a dag. Someone who smokes is a stupid person. And to thereby actually to make it very clear, especially to young people and also middle-aged people, that's a stupid thing to do. And have plain packages, which we have now, and it's interesting. They have, as Ajay Sujata told me this, and it's absolutely true, they designed in Australia sort of the most ugly colour for plain packaging. They wanted to find a colour which psychologically, people didn't like to see. You know what colour it was? It makes you look most less attractive. No, it's actually more like baby poo brown. And baby poo brown is like this brown, but a little bit of green in it. And this is no joke, and I don't mean to demean anybody, but that's exactly the colour of the robes in Wat Bapong. It is true. They've got this green tinge to it. I'll go further there. But nevertheless, these are the little ways we can actually mitigate these things. So instead of just getting scared and depressed about these things, we do something about it. And the chance of you meeting a psychopath, getting murdered, or having horrible crimes committed against you. It's just so small. You've got more chance of dying in a car crash. So please be scared whenever you get into your car and drive anywhere, if you are rational. So first of all, sometimes these are irrational fears, and if you're going to be a Buddhist and wise, you've got to be rational, evidence-based. And so you don't have to be afraid of murder and psychopaths and horrible crimes. So just let it go. Don't even worry about it. It will not happen. And if it does happen, you can come and tell me it's a ghost. I told you, say, Ajahn Brahm, you said it wouldn't happen. Look at me. No, it won't happen. So, but it's true that, you know, some of the causes of these things, they're not that hard to solve if you have the political and financial will. And that's why, you know, just please be politically turned on and just don't just vote for people who's going to make you richer, but make the world a better place. If Mahayana and Theravada are from the same source, from the Buddha, why do they have totally different sutta? Is it the Heart Sutta, Mahadharani Sutta in Mahayana, real one? They have a common core group of sutras. And what's common to both traditions, we can be pretty sure, was early Buddhism. What comes afterwards is not early Buddhism, was added on later. So the Heart Sutra was added on later. So the Mahayana have added on things, bad Mahayanas. And so have the Theravada as well. Abhidharma. That was after the time of the Buddha. So sometimes in the Theravada say, we're original Buddhism, we're more authentic. No, Theravada's added things on as well. And so is Mahayana. But it's great to find out, well, the early teachings of Buddhism were, and they are so simple. Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, meditation, jhana, the simple stuff, and that's the best. It just, you know, it's hard work, but you know, you realize it works. You know, just chanting the Heart Sutra, you're not going to get anywhere just chanting the Heart Sutra. You've got to practice it, for goodness sake. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you. Can you please explain with the noble silence, are we not meant to be making eye contact or smiling at people? Stop looking at me. Stop smiling. Naughty. Now look, of course you can make eye contact. Of course you can smile at people. You can say, ha, and they can't say hi. You can get a piece of paper with hello on it. And on the other side, good morning. So no, of course you can smile, of course you can sort of make eye contact. So that's okay. And if you need to say something, again, say it for goodness sake. But just keep it, you know, just a one word, one sentence. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how do monasteries select the abbot? I don't know what happened. I'm going to read the whole thing. What process is involved? Is the most senior monk or is the most compassionate one? Is it selected by a council, the Sangha, like the Christian church selects a pope? Or does it even happen in this earthly plane? Is psychic powers involved, like mind reading? Do you travel to another realm and seek advice from previous teachers? Exactly. No, it doesn't work like that. It's usually the last monk standing when everyone else gets out. Only an idiot will want to become an abbot. But now what happened to me, those of you who know, that I came here as number two monk. And that was brilliant. That was nice, just tailgating Ajahn Jacaro. And I was having a wonderful time. Until he decided to fall in love and get disrobed and get married. That was really a mean thing to do. And so basically I was left here, sort of holding the baby. So I'm still holding the teddy bear. But that's my training in life, is just to accept whatever happens and don't sort of fight, don't try and get anything, don't try and do anything about it, just make the best of it. So when Ajahn Jacaro disrobed, which was not in my plans, no, plans are just hopeless. And then there you are, sort of basically I was, you know, built the place and I was the obvious choice. But before I took on the role, I just really thought to myself, well, what this is a serious point. I really looked at myself for, you know, a couple of weeks and say, is there any chance of me disrobing? Just like the previous abbot did. Because I saw just the amount of hurt and disappointment that gave. You know, when you have a lot of faith, a lot of commitment into a particular monk, And then later on you find all those things he taught you never really practiced. And I didn't ever want to do that to anybody. And so I looked very carefully and says, no way am I ever going to do anything else other than being a monk. So okay, so I can do this job. Can you imagine that all the teachings I gave you? And imagine if, you know, after this retreat, say, oh, I'm making an announcement, I've fallen in love and I'm going to get married. Well, how would you think? You'd be disgusted. You know, sorry? Congratulations! Jeez. Getting married is not congratulations, it's commiserations. You poor thing. So I'll make sure that that's not going to ever happen. And that recently happened to a monk in Thailand. He was a good friend of mine, Mitsui Shibahashi. And all the people in Thailand I know, they were just devastated because they looked after him, they put lots and lots of donations into his monastery, and they looked to him as a teacher. And then when he just suddenly decided to disrobe and get married, huge amounts of disappointment and even lacking faith in Buddhism. I don't want anything to do with Buddhism anymore. Because if you're a hypocrite, if you say one thing and do another, you know, you think there's no leadership, there's no inspiration left anymore. So, you know, I make sure when I became an abbot, there's no way I'm going to do anything other than be a monk. So that's actually, you know, you've got to be very careful. It's not a job where you get any prestige. You know, you get the opposite. You get criticism, you get people challenging you, checking you out, and it's really hard work. So anyway, that's why there's no monks in this monastery, you know, who want to take over being abbot. I've got no competition. In fact, the senior monks have told me that if I get sick and I have a heart attack and die, they'll be on the next plane out of Perth. That's true, isn't it? Yeah. No doubt at all. Dear Ajahn, for the Aussie bloke who should just get over himself and get with the trend of teddy bear meditation but still has some pathetic insecurity about having a teddy bear on his lap, have you any other suggestions for establishing kindness in meditation? It's an Aussie bloke who should just get over himself and get with the trend of teddy bear meditation. So if you know who that guy is, when he's meditating, especially in the early morning when he's half asleep, sneak up, put the teddy bear on his lap, and then when he comes to, where did the teddy bear come from? No, it's nice having teddy bears on your lap. So give it a try. Dear Ajahn, I really want to learn how to do a mindful meditation on tumor growth, lump or cancerous cells in the sick human body. Please kindly show me step by step. How is this possible, Sadhu? I have never really mentioned this yet about meditation and dealing with sicknesses. I mentioned it to a couple of people, but one of the best teachings is the monster in the emperor's palace. I've taught that in brief. Monster came into the emperor's palace while the emperor was away. So frightening that the monster was allowed to go right into the center of the palace. All the guards froze or hid because they were too scared. And the monster sat in the emperor's throne. At that point, the guards, ministers, soldiers all said, "Get out of here! You don't belong. You're not supposed to sit in our emperor's chair." And of those few unkind words, the monster grew an inch bigger. More ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And that really made everybody in the palace upset. They got out their swords, they clenched their fists, they made threats, "If you don't get out of here quickly, you'll be in big trouble." But every unkind word, unkind act, unkind thought, the monster just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. By the time the emperor came back, the monster was huge and was so stinky, even the maggots crawling on his body threw up. They were sick, they couldn't stand the smell. And it was just an ugly, frightening monster. And the emperor knew what to do. The emperor said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming. Has anyone got you anything to drink yet? Or a cup of tea or some food?" And he meant it. He was kind and welcoming. And of those few kind words, the monster shrank an inch and became less angry and offensive. And so everybody understood what the mistake was. So they started being so kind to this monster. They asked him, "What type of tea do you want? We have Sri Lankan tea, you know, loose leaf, the very best. We have green tea, we have peppermint tea. Do you want honey, sugar, condensed milk with Sri Lankan tea? Yummy. Do you want something to eat? You like a, how about a pizza? Monster size, you can get monster size pizzas. You'll get one." And every kind act, kind word, kind deed, or kind thought, the monster would go an inch smaller, less likely, less smelly, less offensive. So they kept on with the kindness and compassion until the monster was so small, just when it came in, just the same size. But they carried on with the kindness until it was really small, and one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And that's based on a Buddha story in the Udana. He said, we call those monsters anger-eating monsters. They feed on ill will and anger and negativity. Give them anger and they grow an inch bigger and more smelly, more offensive. Welcome them with kindness and they shrink. That is how I teach many people to shrink tumors. Welcome, tumor. Thank you for coming into my palace. Instead of, get out of here, you don't belong, you're kidding me. Welcome. Tough thing to do, but I think you can understand why it works. We go ahead with treatment as well, but you know, because that's the doctor's, you know. If you don't do that because, you know, and you tell the doctor will just really get upset and angry. But this is what you can do yourself, in your own time. You're only with the doctor a short time. Because a lot of, you know, a lot of the cancers are stress produced. And if you welcome these things, there's no more stress. But you've got to welcome them properly. Not, the door of my heart's open to you, cancer. Come in, I can live with you. Welcome. Is there anything I can do for you? Why aren't you shrinking yet? You see, that's just playing around. You've got to really do it 100% for these things to work. Dear Bhante, please explain the meaning of the following metaphor for jhana practice taken from the Anguttara Nikaya. Just as an archer or archer's apprentice undergoes training on a straw man or heap of clay and then at later time becomes a long-distance shooter, a sharpshooter, one who splits a great body, so too a bhikkhu enters and dwells in jhana. I suppose that, you know, you're going, what's the whole... sutta, but I haven't read that for a while, but it probably is you train on something like just learning how to let go of easy things, you know, just like past and future, and then you try on harder things, like training you can't just let go that easy at first, but you keep training, 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 until you become a sharp shooter. One who can split a great body. That's a nice time for the archer story. It takes a bit of a while, but actually I've got too much of a while. I'll do that tomorrow morning, the archer story, because otherwise I won't get through. But that's how I understand that. Just very simple, just it takes a long time of training to be able to let go that much to get into a jhana. But the archer story tomorrow. I'll put that in there for tomorrow. Beloved Ajahn, I love compassion, metta, etc. to me from non-self. How to cultivate or realize, understand non-self? I wish you a very happy long life, at least 100 years. That is not compassion, you hypocrite. You said you know beloved, you have compassion and metta, and you want me to be old age and sick with arthritis and all this sort of stuff. So that's not compassionate and kind. Please let me die young. Okay. Whoever said this, can I see the whole sutta tomorrow and then we'll have a better answer. When there is background light and the breath is unnoticeable, where should be the focus? What should be my object? Thank you. One of the things you should focus on is the thing which is watching. So keep that very still and peaceful. Just like in the Ajahn Chah story of the still forest pool, that sitting very still, he had to not just look at the animals, but make sure he wasn't moving. Because only when he wasn't moving would the animals come out to play. So you have to be very, very still. So that means that some of your mindfulness, you have to be watching the one who's watching. And make sure that's very peaceful and very still. And then the nimitta lasts, and also it goes stronger and stronger. How do you deal with allegations when, despite your best attempts, people choose to find something nothing to tarnish or discredit you? A good example is the builder's gossip that you referred to earlier. Yeah. Do you ignore it, let it be? Do you have to justify yourself? Now, one thing you can do, there's a story which is in the opening of the door of your heart, because there was a time, especially about 15 or 20 years ago, there were so many monks in Thailand getting busted for having mistresses, and it was in a newspaper scandal. These were famous monks. And so one evening at Nolamara Temple, I decided to make my confession. A Friday night talk, 300 people have been following me for such a long time. And I told people, it's been on my mind, I need to confess to you, that some years previously, I'd spent some of the happiest moments of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other so much, and she was another man's wife. Keep a straight face, that's your problem. And people gasped. One person was almost out the door. I said, oh no, not Ajahn Brahm too. And then I explained that that woman was my mother. It was another man's wife. And it was when I was young, when I was a baby, we had such a wonderful time in the loving arms. I loved my mother, she loved me, and she was another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we had a wonderful time together. And I say that because some allegations, all it really is just misunderstandings. You know, when I said that, I made a really good point. How easy it is, you know, to hear something and get totally misunderstand what's going on. Now, one of the questions you might ask, why do the nuns wear dark brown, you know, dark chocolate? Why do the monks have milk chocolate robes? And there's a good reason. There was, years and years ago, there was a visiting nun. She wore exactly the same kind of robes as I was wearing. So she was in our city temple in Nolamara. And when she finished lunch, you know, I finished lunch, you know, we had the lunch together, the monks and the nuns. And then one of the ladies wanted to show her around Perth. So she got in the car and was just driving off from the temple in Nolamara. And one of the regular Thai ladies looked through the window of her car. She saw a young Thai girl and this person in a brown robe sitting next to her. And she screamed out, Ajahn Brahm, he's going off with a girl in a car. Because the brown robe looked the same. And it was very fortunate, I just came out at that time. Ajahn Brahm, which one's Ajahn Brahm? And if she hadn't seen me, she would have thought, and said, I saw it with my own eyes, Ajahn Brahm going out with a girl. And that's why, you know, we have, you know, different kind of robes. So it's obvious now who's a nun and who's a monk. So, you know, you don't get that confusion anymore. It was a close call. If I hadn't had the good fortune to come out at that time, the rumor would have gone around. And how can you disprove rumors? The monks say, oh, no, no, he was with me. Yeah, the monks would say that, wouldn't they? So allegations are very, very hard to disprove. It's hard to disprove you didn't do something. And that's the problem. Sometimes people, they're assumed to be guilty. And you've got to prove your innocence. It's hard to prove your innocence. Really, it should be proving guilt the other way around. So allegations are very nasty. So when other people give those allegations, please make sure that you're above reproach, especially if you ever become a senior monk or a senior nun, because some people are just out to get you and out to prove that you know you're not the real thing. So you have to be very, very careful with your precepts. And number two, if those allegations do come along, you're going to get them sooner or later. So just, if you have a very good foundation in virtue, that people know that you're a good person, you wouldn't do such things. So your record in virtuous conduct will protect you when allegations come up. They say, oh, no, a person wouldn't do that. So that's actually how we can do that. There was, even some years ago, it must have been about 10 years ago now, on a Friday night in Nolamara, somebody on the cars on Nolamara, they put the, do you remember that, Abby? They put these posters on there. Ajahn Brahm, they had to use my lay name. Peter Betts, my lay name, is committing adultery with my wife. You know, do not trust him, or something. And they just put that out on the cars at night time. I mean, how, they didn't know who it was. I was interested, who am I supposed to be committing adultery with? Then they put a name on there. So when you saw that, it made an announcement, look, any allegations of this, please come up. I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. These are the ex-presidents, these are the people who've got good reputations in our Buddhist. I go and talk to them. You know, I've got nothing to hide. So you faced it, and it was just, we're not quite sure who it was. People had all sorts of ideas who it might be. But, you know, just because I had a very good reputation, no one believed it. And they said, okay, please, bring it up. Come and talk about it. You know, go to the police or whatever, to at least, you know, come up with what you're talking about. So it only lasted about, didn't even last a day. I think it just, people just forgot about it. So that's, you have to be very careful with allegations. So, you can't just ignore it. Just bring it up. If someone alleges something against you, tell everybody. You know, they've alleged that Venerable Gotami is an MI5 agent. Bring it up. And say, investigate. And say, come on, look at me, my age. So that's actually how you deal with them. Don't hide them. Don't just bring them up, discuss it with people, and then your good conduct of the past will be what saves you. Dear Ajahn, most we strictly abide by the 8 precepts in order to experience nimittas and jhana, or must we strictly? No, 5 precepts is enough. I have not been keeping the 8 precepts, like on New Year's Eve, drinking alcohol with friends, going to casinos. No. Is this the reason why my meditation experience is not fruitful? I do try to keep 8 precepts, but sometimes with friends it's hard to break the rules. If keeping the 8 precepts is a must do, then I can focus on it for the time and come back to doing meditation at a later date in the future. 5 precepts is enough. 5 precepts, you don't take alcohol. And it's easy not to take alcohol. It's such an easy thing to do. One of my friends, now he decided, this Westerner, decided to give up taking alcohol. And he told me the first time he went out with his friends, they offered him a drink and he said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I can't take alcohol. And his friend, now Buddhism is pretty well known in modern culture now, even in Australia. His friend said, oh, you're a Buddhist, great, Buddhism is a really good religion. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go, have a drink. And so he was stuck, he didn't know how to answer that. So, next time, he said, he managed to find a solution. Next time he was out with his friends and said, have a drink, and he said, no, I can't take a drink, doctor's orders. And his friends never questioned that at all. Said, oh, okay, fair enough. And when he told me that that was his solution with his friends, when you say, I can't drink because of doctor's orders, straight away I told him, aren't you keeping one precept by breaking another? Lying. You're perfectly fit and healthy, I know that. And that's when he reminded me that sometimes, you know, you guys know more Buddhism than I do. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, you should know that in many sutras, the Buddha compared himself to a doctor. It was doctor's orders. Dr. Buddha's orders. So he was right, you know, you can't blame him there. So it is doctor's orders, Dr. Buddha's orders. So that way you can find a way of not, and people respect you more if you don't drink. I stopped drinking when I was a student. And that was just such a courageous thing to do, because I didn't like going to parties, going out with girls and having good fun. And just giving up drinking, I thought, I'm not going to get invited to any more parties. But the opposite happened. I got invited to more parties. You know why? Because they wanted somebody sober to drive them home, and that was me. There's lots of advantages. So you don't have to, if you think about it, it's so easy to keep that fifth precept, and people respect you for you. Does the good deeds we do in this life affect the future in this life, or would it affect the next life only? It affects both. Now, this is a good question, because I'm trying to focus on meditation. If you remember the good deeds you have done at the beginning of your meditation, that gives you a big boost of energy. So if you're tired, depressed, nothing is really working, stop for a while and remember some really wonderful act you've done. An act of kindness and generosity. Remember it. Focus on it. Really linger on it. Attach to it. Really get into it. And that will give you such beautiful happiness. And once you've got sort of aroused in happiness and energy, then start meditating. And it really, really gives you a big boost. If that doesn't work, just be inspired what other people do. Now, all the people who made this retreat center possible, people like, you know, she's gone now, I can say, Bianca, you know, she doesn't get paid, you know, for, this is her holiday time. And she spends it, you know, looking after you, making sure you get well fed, and she does such a brilliant job. She doesn't get anything for this, this is just her service. You get the two caretakers at the back, they don't get paid either. They're running around for you guys, making sure you've got a place to stay. Wow, that is impressive. So you get this beautiful mood interrupt. There are really good people in this world. And you think, wow. You think of that, you reflect upon that, and that gives you incredible energy. Whenever I get tired, and I'm overseas teaching, and I get really exhausted sometimes, and I have to give a talk, and 1,000 people, 2,000, 3,000 people are coming, and I'm wiped out, I'm done, I'm finished. That's my trick. I'll start remembering some of the good stuff I've done. As soon as I do that, the back straightens up, you can see the energy just coming up inside you. You really helped, you've really done something, wow. And then you get this incredible energy. I do that sometimes for meditation too. What have I done? All the talks I've given, all the advice I've given during the interviews, even just building this place. If you want to be inspired, I told this to someone earlier. You on this side over here, you are sitting on wood which the monks laid. This place was supposed to be finished about 2 months before the opening day. The builder promised me, yes, it will be finished. The night before the opening ceremony, this hall was only half finished, completed with wood. And the ceremony is going to start the following morning. So the monks came and laid this floor till 4 a.m. And then there's a huge ceremony the next day, the opening ceremony. So all you here are sitting on a floor which was laid by the monks, working all night. Wow. That's really holy. That's, oh yeah. I'm going to meditate. That's actually how good deeds really get you going in your meditation this week. You're let alone in your later life or the next life. Now, one good deed, one impressive deed, you can milk that, you know, again and again and again, 1,000 times. One really good act. So this is actually what inspires you. Dear Ajahn, thank you so much for your teachings. A contemporary secular Buddhist teacher states that rebirth was not part of the original teachings of the Buddha, but added in a later part of the religion. What would be your response to this? Now, the response is, this is a bunch of gomayan. Gomayan. And this is Pali word. And it's a very good word you should all use for statements such as rebirth was added much later. Go is a Pali word for bull. Mayang, it was what comes out of the back end of a bull. You're not really supposed to say that word, you know, so you know, to get around this, I say, it's what a bunch of go mayang. You know what that means? You know, ball, you know, SH, you know the rest. And it, that anyone could say that just shows how ignorant they are of the Buddha's teachings. He said this time and time again about rebirth. This is the first insight which comes up after the jhanas, the memory of the past lives. Under the Bodhi tree, it was his first, they call Vijja, of the three insights which come up, the insight into his previous lives. And it's said so many times, even in the suttas I mentioned yesterday, when the Buddha said his previous life as a monk in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. It comes up again and again and again. So anyone who says this, they haven't actually looked at what the Buddha actually taught, and these are the most authentic teachings you can get. But it doesn't matter, that guy who says that, in his next life you will believe in rebirth. So I mean, look at, read it for yourself, it just comes out of, in every page. So why do people believe that? These don't believe me, don't believe anybody, just go inside those suttas and have a look for yourself. There are some things which, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, you know, like, you know, can you become enlightened? Sorry, can you become a stream winner without a jhana? You know, that's not clear in the suttas. But this is very clear, that Buddha taught rebirth. That's part of the teachings. Dear Ajahn, when one experiences pity, sukha, and upeka, is that a jhana? No, of course not. Sometimes when Australia beat England in the cricket, and if you follow cricket, yay! That's pity, sukha. It's coarse, but it's still pity, sukha. So there's all sorts of pity sukha, there's worldly pity sukha. Maybe, you know, your favorite food. You know, you've been really hungry because you haven't had your favorite food. And tomorrow, Sri Lankan people are coming. And it's your favorite food is coming tomorrow from Sri Lanka. Yes! That's pity sukha. But it's not jhana. So no, the particular jhana is pity sukha, but it's born of the senses disappearing. It's a particular flavor of pity sukha. Now, when the five senses have disappeared, oh, what a relief. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that the main reason monks disrobe is because of women. Well, here we go. When I was in Thailand, we'd go off into the jungles, and you know, there were tigers there. There was one monk in one of these monasteries, it was after I came here, he was walking back, you know, after the evening meeting, you know, through the jungle path, a big tiger jumped right in front of him. Huge tiger, and just like as far as you are away from me, and just stared at him. And he, you know, he's actually from Adelaide, he was an IT expert, and you know, he was just really terrified. Fortunately, the tiger never ate him, but just, you know, went off back into the jungle after 5 or 10 minutes. But he disrobed afterwards. He said, this is too much for me. The stress of an IT job is bad enough, but this, no. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, we were afraid of tigers, because, well, not really, they never ate anybody. But, when I was a young man, they said, no, you should not be afraid of tigers, be afraid of tigers. Girls. They've eaten more monks. They ate Ajahn Jagaro. So, now it's, what about nuns? It can't possibly be men. That's what in the main reason why nuns disrobe. We haven't had nuns long enough yet, but they do. I told that story the other day about, not a nun, but the woman from one of our old committee members went to Dharamsala, and she was sitting next to Richard Gere. I mean, that really, really messed up her meditation for days. You know, that's when Richard Gere was young and really handsome and stuff. And imagine, you know, that, I don't know the girls, what, you know, who you think is your favorite guy, but a lot of these people, they're becoming Buddhists now. Amazing just how many stars are Buddhists. And so the person you like the most, they probably could be a Buddhist. And you know, I'm getting quite famous now, so sometimes celebrities come on my meditation courses. So So who knows, the next time you come here, you might be sitting next to Justin Bieber. What will that do to your meditation? Sister Upeka, will you say, if he just puts you in the just say, Sister Upeka, just run away with me. The girls and boys are exactly the same, so we haven't had enough nuns yet around to do this sort of stuff, but you know, it will happen. It will happen sooner or later. But it's not just, you know, it's not just women or nuns. Sometimes it's because, for one reason or another, the monk or the nun doesn't have happiness. Now, obviously, if they get some decent meditation, they have happiness. Or they get some meaning in their life from other areas, such as service. You know, and then you know, they have some meaning. But sometimes, if a monk or a nun, they abandon so much and they don't get much meaning in life. They're not doing a service, they're not really contributing much to this world. And after a while, you know, just like everybody else, say, what am I doing this job for? How many of you started a job you thought was really good and you found, this is not me, I don't want to do this anymore? And you change your job. And that's like being a monk or a nun. Sometimes it's not who you are and you just, okay, it's time to leave. So it's not just always because of women and men and lust and stuff. That's only one factor. A lot of times it's no real satisfaction. And in the end, it's much better that a person is happy as a lay person, unhappy as a monk, or unhappy as a nun. This is not the Catholic Church where once you're a priest, you're always a priest. That is really, really hard. So if you feel like you're uncomfortable, then you can leave. Go. Okay. Well, let's try it. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you are the greatest teacher in Buddhism, current time. At last, someone appreciates my talent. I'm not only the greatest teacher, I'm also the most humble teacher in modern times. There's no teacher who's more humble than me. In fact, I'm really trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records as the most humblest of teachers. Well, I say, if you're humble, you might as well flaunt it. Now, first of all, when somebody says that, what would be your reaction? Say, oh, no. Why can't we receive praise? And this is one of the things which I've often noticed. When anyone praises you, say, oh, no, just make fun of it. But no, somebody is actually, you know, is actually praising me. Why can't I receive that praise? Why is it most people always receive criticism? Somebody else writes, dear Ajahn Brahm, you tell the worst jokes in the whole world. And I've heard them so many times. And just, if you tell that carrot joke again, I'm going to become a Christian. And I think, oh no, you're right. And I get depressed. Why is it that criticism is so easy for you to accept? And you accept it straight away. But praise you reject. So the reason I said that, if someone praises you, receive it. Respect them. And when I receive praise, you don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. So when someone says, you're a wonderful man, Venerable Gotami, I'm really nice to see you in prayer mode. As people will say, yes, thank you, you're right. He says, oh, no. So always receive praise. I'm qualified to say that because I'm a Sri Lankan Buddhist who passed the final exams of Dharma School syllabus in Sri Lanka, but until I listened to you on YouTube, I didn't understand Second and Third Noble Truths in real life. So thank you from everyone in my situation. You are a very discerning Buddhist. Thank you. I accept that. What is Abhidharma and who wrote it? Is it Eight Noble Path is part of the Abhidharma? Okay, Abhidharma. It's only mentioned in one place in the suttas, which is interesting, in the Gaudisana Sutta. And the Gaudisana Sutta is of the forest monk, about what a forest monk should be good at. Now, a forest monk should be good at meditation, because you spend all your time in the forest. You're not good at chanting, you're not even all that good at knowing the suttas and studies. You're supposed to be a meditator, a forest monk. And they say the forest monk should be really good at Abhidharma and Abhivinaya. What could that possibly mean? Abhidhamma is the deeper Dhamma. The Abhivinaya, the deeper training in your precepts. It means you have this understanding, you know, of just more than the Four Noble Truths, how to explain those Four Noble Truths. The explanations based on deep meditative experience. So, quite frankly, what I've been teaching you here the last few days is Abhidhamma, the real Abhidhamma. The deeper understanding of the teachings. However, what happened is that some scholars got a hold of that, and they started concocting what now we call the Abhidhamma. Just trying to get all the teachings of the Buddha, put them all together and trying to systemize them. Instead of, the Buddha would teach people, you know, this is what Ajahn Chah would say, never answer the question, answer the person. You know, in other words, don't just look at the question, ask where it's coming from. And the Buddha would always do that with his talks. They weren't supposed to be some theoretical lecture like in science or history. This is the truth. This is, you know, to be taken away from the context and just looked upon as some ultimate truth. He was talking about a problem and how it's solved. So when you try and systemize that, take it out of the context and try to make this theoretical Abhidhamma, it really misses the point. And it also makes a lot of big mistakes, already mentioned there, like the path and fruit. It is inconsistent with what the Buddha said. So not only do people look at that and know that it's obviously after the time of the Buddha, it is inconsistent with the suttas. They also, there was one of these fellows I really respect, Professor A.K. Warder. Now he was, I don't know if he was, thought of himself as a Buddhist, but he was a linguist at Cambridge. And he was one of these people who could look at, you know, some Sanskrit or Pali phrases and know by their grammar and by their vocabulary roughly when they were written. Just like if you looked at some Chaucer, and then you looked at some Shakespeare, and then you looked at some, Charles Dickens, and then you looked at some Harry Potter, you would pretty much know which was early and which was later. Even Shakespeare, the language and the construction of sentences was so much different than Harry Potter. And so language actually changes. The words change their meaning. The way that sentences are put together are totally different. And that's how these people like A.K. Ward, he looked at the Abhidhamma and said, that's about 200 years after the sutras. The language is different. So there's so many ways you can know that that came a long time after the Buddha. However, I have the following to get away with saying that. If a young monk said that, you'd be jumped on by scholars in Sri Lanka and especially from Burma. And say, you're destroying Buddhism. But this is actually truth, and it's so easy to prove. So please, let's get back to basic Buddhism. Dear Ajahn, we're meditating. I have been unable to go further than full awareness of the breath. Often the mind feels bright and the breath is peaceful, but I haven't yet perceived any piti sukha or the delightful breath. Should I make a suggestion like, may I breathe in and out experiencing piti sukha? Or should I continue to be patient, waiting in the moment, and try to refine my present moment awareness with the breath? Yeah, all of those are good, but you may make a determination, oh, may I breathe in experiencing piti sukha? Yeah, you can do that. Breathing in, instead of peace, breathing out, letting go, breathing in happiness, breathing out joy. One of my friends is a very, still really good supporter of the bhikkhunis, Ajahn Gunha. Now that was his meditation teaching. Now he would teach people, and this is the only thing he would teach. He said, watch the breath, breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. The word sabai is a Thai word, means nice and easy, comfortable, oh yes, that's sabai. So, you know, ask Dr. Purnom, she knows the word sabai. It's a beautiful word, sabai, sabai, you know, means to take it easy. And this is what he was saying, breathe in, taking it easy, beautiful, wonderful, relax. Breathe in, sabha. Breathe out, sabha. That's what he would teach. And that's actually breathing in, just beauty, joyfully. Breathing in the Pithi Sutta straight away. And it works. The other way, which I'd encourage you to do, I already mentioned it, start off with inspiring yourself. Think of some beautiful thing you've done today. You know, you brought someone a cup of tea because they weren't feeling well. You know, or you just opened the door to someone. The last cake, the muffin or whatever it was, and you know that somebody liked it, so instead of eating it yourself, you gave it to them. Simple things. And when you're kind, remember that. That gives you a lot of happiness and Pithi Sukha. So I may actually say some more about that tomorrow morning. Dear Ajahn, do you eat meat? I mentioned that to you afterwards. I don't eat meat, I only eat vegetables. When the cow or the sheep is lobotomized, and then it becomes a vegetable, then I can eat it. And anyway, what is a cow? A cow is just processed grass. I'm not going to go any further there, I'm going to get in trouble already. You mentioned sitting and walking meditation. What about lying down meditation? I saw a corner at the back of this hall, not for sitting and walking, but for lying down meditation. Does this belong to anyone? Yes, it does. Is it possible to do such dhyana if we have lying down meditation? Fellow in the corner, I don't think he minds saying, he's got a chronic back condition, so it's really in pain. So that's why, you know, he's lying down over there. If you're in such pain, fine. If you're not, lying down will create that pain. Be careful, don't lie down. They say if you lie down a lot, if you stay too long in a horizontal position, in your next life you'll be reborn as one of those horizontal beings who slither along the ground on their bellies. No, you won't. But no, that is actually for somebody. If you want to do the laying down meditation, do it in your room. Just, you know, on your bed. Because if you do it here, the too many of you will fall asleep. And when you fall asleep, you make such a loud noise. So in your room, fine. What do you think about Osho? To me, his teachings is very closer to yours. Oh my goodness, I'm in trouble. He was a real scallywag. You know, he was someone who said, Osho, that's Rajneesh. You know, he arrived in the United States on a medical visa. Because he had some medical trouble. And at the airport, there was an ambulance waiting for him. And there was also a Rolls Royce waiting for him. And he said, I'll take the Rolls. And how many Rolls did he have? He had heaps of them. So, I remember just when he was threatening to come to Perth. And he sent his offsider, Sheila, Ma Sheila over here. And people loved her on the news because she was so rude to everybody. So it was great news because everybody absolutely hated her. And that was one time I was teaching meditation in the prison down at Bunbury, which is south of here. And on the afternoon, I could only have to go on the lunch train. You know, so I usually had a packed lunch. And I got there, I was staying with a Catholic priest, you know, in the house. They were very good. It's nice actually to be able to look after one another. I really got to know them really well in Bunbury. And I'd go there in the evening to teach and come back the following morning. And in the afternoon, I used to like going to the beach in Bunbury to sit meditation. And I had some great experiences. One of the most embarrassing experiences, I don't mind telling you this, I was meditating, you know, a couple of hours. It's nice. No one was there. It was really peaceful in the afternoon. And when I came out of my meditation after 2 hours, this is no exaggeration, there were two people sitting on either side of me. I wouldn't have minded, but both were in bikinis, 17-year-old, what you would call hot chicks. There's a bikini-clad, no, redhead and a bikini-clad blonde, and they were just sitting next to me. If anyone had taken a photograph of that, I'd have been dead. You can't explain that. But what had actually happened, it was the last exam for the university entrance, the TEE in those days. That was that afternoon. They finished, the last exam, finished with school. they got into their bathers, get down to the beach and have fun. And they saw me there sitting perfectly still, and they were interested. And they were just sitting there, literally waiting for me to come out and to ask questions about meditation. It's really impressive. How can you sit so still like that for such a long time? And now this Buddhism is really interesting. It was totally innocent. But, you know, would you have believed me if you see that photo in the newspapers? So that's what happens sometimes. But on another occasion, I was sitting there and I heard a rock come right past my ear. And then another one. And I heard someone shout out, "Hey Rajneeshi, get off our beach." They thought I was one of Osho's followers because I was wearing this orange, and they thought it was an orange person. And then a few more rocks came past, and I realized I can't just sit here, because sooner or later one of those is going to hit. So I stood up. Don't run away. I walked towards them, towards the rock throwers, a bunch of kids, maybe 6 or 7, throwing stones at me. And it's amazing, when you don't show any fear, you walk towards them. All of them ran away, except for one. And it's just only just one monk, and these were 13, 14-year-old kids. And I walked towards them. "What are you throwing rocks at me for?" "So you're a Rajneeshi." "So I'm not a Rajneeshi, I'm a Buddhist monk." "Oh, we thought you were one of those Osho followers, and that Marshila, who talks such bad language on our TV screens. We thought you were one of those." So, that is my relationship with Osho. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Jhana Grove is like Nirvana on earth. Get it? Heaven on earth, Nirvana on earth. Good enough. "Thank you for your teachings. I am a little confused about the story this morning regarding the Arahant who gave up his 3 wives to become a monk. Is that a metaphor about the realization of the emptiness of worldly things? As the reason I am confused is because I am thinking of an Arahant would realize that it doesn't matter whether he is a monk or a husband. It's all the same in the end." It's not the same in the end. Because if you have a wife, you have to have attachments, you have to look after the wife looks after you. There's so many entanglements, out there in the home. So that's why, the fellow is, "Look, I've got no lust anymore. I can't satisfy you sexually. I'm not interested in money anymore to get things and buy things for you." Remember in those days, the man was the breadwinner and had to look after the women. He said, "Look, I can't do that anymore. But I realize I have responsibilities for you still. So please, what do you want to do? And I'll just sort out the affairs, make sure each one of you is happy as you can possibly be. Then I'm off to become a monk." So that's exactly what he did, to make sure that they were looked after, cared for, and then off he went. But he said, "I can't be your husband anymore. I can't have that one-on-one commitment to you anymore." "Do we need to get all the 4 jhanas to become stream winner, or just first jhana or couple of miles sufficient? If we need to get only first jhana, at least there is hope. If not, and a sad face afterwards." The answer is, I'm sorry, only one is enough. One is enough for you if you're smart. So one is enough. "Can you tell us where in the meditation or the Buddha statues come from? They appear to have the Thai royal family crest on them. Were they a gift from the king?" Yeah, that one was. That was a gift from the king. I think that came on one of my birthdays, I think. They brought it over here for that. So that was a gift from the king. He only made, I think, about 18 or something. So we got the Australian one from here. The one outside that the monks call the Disco Buddha. I think you understand why. Yeah, it was actually, that's from the King of Thailand. "Dear Ajahn, continue my question from yesterday. If we die, we can get into jhana. Can you teach us how to get it?" I have been teaching you. Do exactly the same. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just relax when you die. Now, one of the great things about dying is you've got to let go. You've got no choice in the matter. All your friends and relations, you've got to let them go. Your money, you've got to let them go. Everything you have to let go. Except that story of that lawyer lawyer is always looking for loopholes, always looking for a way of getting out of the trouble. So he actually thought of a way to take it with him when he dies, all his money. He was on his deathbed at home, and he told his wife, you know, please get all the money you can out of my account in two suitcases in high denomination notes. Now, only $100 bills, that's the highest denomination note in Australia. Only $100 bills, put as many as you can into these two suitcases and place them in the attic above my bedroom, right above my bed. Because when I die, as I go up, I can grab onto the suitcases and take them up to heaven with me. And being not willing to argue, don't argue with a lawyer. So she just did what she was told, got hundreds of thousands of dollars in these two suitcases, put them exactly above where he was lying in bed, in the attic. Day later he died. No, day later she went up into the attic. The two suitcases were still there. And she said, stupid man, he should have put them in the room below his bed, because I knew which way he was going. So you can't take it with you whether you put them above or below. How to lead our family into Nimitta Jhana when they almost die of beside care? Okay, now that's a good question, because have you ever seen people when they're dying in their friends' relationship, go towards the light, they say. And even actually, I saw that in a joke book. You know, because I get some of my material from joke books. And in the joke book it actually said, if your doctor tells you before the operation, whatever you do, don't go towards the light. It means it's touch and go whether you're going to die or not. people know this, go towards the light. So when you have that, people dying, tell them to go towards the light, just let go, be peaceful, just merge with the light. Just, again, and don't control, don't try. Let go of all these things. So telling people when they're dying to let go, let go, let go is a beautiful thing for them to do. Ajahn Brahm, jhanas and sex. Is it possible to enjoy and practice both? Some with sexual life attains jhanas, not at the same time. But, you know, just basically, if you want a truthful answer, yeah, you can. Because that's my experience. The first time I got a deep meditation was about 6 or 7 days after having sex with my girlfriend in Gloucester. Blew me away. And it was useful for me because, you know, I could actually compare the two. And it wasn't any theory. And just, sorry girlfriend, you know, you don't come into the picture. You're not on the table. This is far better than sex with your girlfriend. And that was just amazing. You know what I thought after that experience as a layperson? I thought, why hadn't anybody told me about this before? You can have this bliss which was way, way better than sex. And that was my reaction. Crikey, this is available for human beings and no one ever told me. So that's why I'm telling you. Stillness, yes, but what about right effort and energy? Ah, good one. Energy in Buddhism is called virya. You may know that word. And that is related to the word vira, which is the hero. And the hero, this is like basically heroic stuff. And in the time of the Buddha, the hero was like the soldier who would go into battle, willing to sacrifice and let go of everything, not keeping anything back from battle, willing to be wounded and even killed. It was a hero, someone who's willing to surrender and let go of everything. When you understand the Pali, energy is not just ordinary energy, it's the letting go energy, ability to sacrifice everything, heroic energy. That's what it really is. And as for the right effort, you look at what the right effort is, it is anything, whatever you need to do, to manage to arouse wholesome states of mind, like peace, like stillness, like compassion, to maintain those great states, to keep out unwholesome states, and to avoid them coming in the first place. And it doesn't tell you what the effort is, it tells you if it works, is why effort. And you will try, if you like, to put forth what you think is effort, struggling and striving, and you will not get wholesome, good states of mind. You'll get tiredness, stress, and you know that because many of you have done that. So really, it is the effort to say no, to stop, to renounce, to go against the stream, not to follow the stream of wanting and craving. And it takes a bit of effort to not do things in the same old way you do in the world. It takes effort to make peace, be kind, and be gentle. When you do make that effort and stop the stream of craving, then it becomes effortless. But you've got to make that effort to say no, first of all, to stop. That's the effort, the right effort. It's not an easy thing to understand. That's why many people lose it on that factor. Last night, you said an entrance to stream winner path is going to become a stream winner before the end of his or her life. What are the qualities of a person who has entered into a stream winner path? How can one identify such a person? Is this in a sutta? Okay, now there are two types of people who are on the path to being a stream winner. They call one the Dharma follower, the other the faith follower. Now those two, it's just a person's got, like a faith follower, so much faith and confidence in these teachings of the Buddha, not in Ajahn Brahm, not in Mahasi Sayadaw, not in Thich Nhat Hanh, in the Buddha, that they will follow that path. They will follow the Eightfold Path because their faith is just so strong. They don't understand why, maybe, but they're going to follow that. They're going to keep their precepts. They're going to give up alcohol just out of faith. They're going to sort of meditate. They're going to let go just because, you know, they've got such faith that they're going to do it. That's why, you know, sometimes I've seen some people, like the especially Asian people who are, you know, old people, say in Thailand, they follow their master or their teacher 100%. They don't doubt at all. And so that's why some of those people, they can sit for hours and they get into jhanas. Now they're not much knowledgeable about the suttas, but they follow an Ajahn Chah and they say, well, you know, we've got so much faith in this guy that we'll follow it, and that's why they get results. So first of all, faith. That is a dangerous one because you might have faith in the wrong person, which sometimes happens. There's many scallywags like Osho and other people arise from time to time. And people have so much faith in them, it's so such a shame. They waste a lot of time. The other one is the Dharma follower. You've had some understanding, some insight. You understand what the Eightfold Path is, and you know that, you know, this is going to work. You've had some experience of it working. Not all the way to jhanas and to the first stage of enlightenment, but enough to give you, yeah, confidence based on your experience. And that's the second type of follower. You're going to follow the Eightfold Path because you know from experience it's working. And of course, most people are a combination of those two. You have a bit of faith, you have a bit of experience. Some lots of experience, little faith. Some lots of faith, little experience. Basically, it means you are committing your life to the Eightfold Path. Now, you know you've got to do it. Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. That is someone who's gained the path. The Eightfold Path. You're on the path, the Eightfold Path, to stream winning. So you're going to get there anyway, because that path leads in only one direction. So that's the stream winner. And of course, when you see non-self, you see just now all these things which you thought were happiness or suffering, all these things you thought were permanent, you see them vanish, they disappear. Water is not permanent. You're a frog, there's no water left. When you see that which you took to be yourself, your controller, the doer, the will, or even the consciousness, this thing which is looking at me right now or hearing me, that is not you. When you see that 100% totally, there's nothing left which you can hang a hat of me on. Then you're a stream winner. And this is big experience. Just kicks you upside down. You realize that, you know, the way you've been looking from so many lifetimes, you've missed it. And now, Jesus, why couldn't I see that before? You don't say Jesus, by the way. That's because I've brought up. That's because I've brought up as a Christian. But this is the sort of thing which happens. So it's a big experience. It's not just, oh yeah, I must be a stream winner. No, it's huge. So, and that's what happens. And then, you know, you gain the stream winner. Dear Ajahn, is intuition related to insight or is it thought-based? That's a brilliant question. No, it is related to insight. That's why this, you know, psychologist, famous experiment, giving people a task, half the people intuit the answer. The other one, think it through. And they always found, every time they do this test, if you intuit the answer, what you feel is the right answer is always more likely to be correct than if you think it through. If you feel it, what's the right answer? It's always more accurate. So insight is even bigger than intuition. Insight is when you really can see the answer. You don't need to intuit it anymore, you don't need to think it, you can see it. Dear Ajahn, are you believing in Feng Shui? And should we find a good date, special calendar in Chinese, to open business, move house or get married? Thank you with metta. Every date is not a good date to get married. I shouldn't say things like that being about, but I'm being honest. All the marriage jokes, the three rings of marriage, the first ring of marriage, engagement ring, second ring of marriage, wedding ring, the third ring of marriage? Supper ring, yeah. No, anyway, sometimes it works okay. No, you don't need to find a special date. Now is the best time. Now is the special day. If you want to do it now. That's the only time. Believe in Feng Shui. I had a friend. He was having trouble with his relationship. He brought in a Feng Shui master, and the Feng Shui master said, the furniture in your house is badly arranged. Rearrange the furniture and your marriage or your relationship will improve. And I asked him afterwards, well, did you? He said, yeah, I did. And did it work? He said, yeah, it worked perfectly. When my wife was out shopping, I rearranged the furniture against the front door so she couldn't come in. Now there's no relationship problems anymore. That's a Feng Shui joke. But when I was away somewhere, somebody, I don't know if they're here or they told me, they brought a Feng Shui master into the main hall of Bodhinyana. And now they didn't know what we could do in that place. And when they went in there, they said, wow, this place has immense Feng Shui, and the most powerful Feng Shui I think he said he'd ever felt. In the front, in the back, no. In the front, yes. And that, you can feel that, because I should have mentioned this earlier. Some of you have already walked over to Bodhinyana to meditate in the hall over there. If you haven't got good meditation here, you'll have great meditation over there. That's got power, that hall. Especially in the front. In the back, just behind the walls where we keep the bones of dead people. That's why in the back is not so good. The front is immense. So have a try that, at least once. Go over there and it's brilliant energy over there. Because we've been meditating in there for years and got some great experiences. Great monks and nuns have been in that hall. So it's got oomph into it. So that's got great Feng Shui. Not because of its orientation. In fact, the orientation is all wrong. Because the Buddha statue is facing west. And if you look in the sutras, the Buddha is always supposed to face east. And that was such a concern for the Thai people when we first came here. Ajahn Chakra was the abbot, and he put that facing west. And the Thai people complained. We had a visitor for one of Ajahn Chah's chief monks. And it was Ajahn Jan. You know, he's basically his second in command at that time. And they complained. He said, these Western monks have got it all wrong. The Buddha is facing west when it should be facing east. And this monk, a really good disciple of Ajahn Chah, said, well, if the Buddha didn't like it, he'd turn around by himself. And that was the end of the complaint. And it's been facing west ever since. And there we go, it's great Feng Shui over there. It's Just go over there, you can feel it. Last night you mentioned stream entry on entering the path and stream winning. Could you please talk more about both of these? I just answered that question. What's the difference between a fully enlightened one and the stream winner, please? Again, sort of answered it. A stream winner, look, this is the best simile, again from the Buddha. Now, sometimes you just cannot improve on the Buddha's similes. He said it's like a person who's been shipwrecked at sea, and you're floating in the ocean, and you look around, you see dry land over there. You see safety. That's the stream winner. They've seen safety from samsara, from rebirth. And then they start swimming towards the dry land. Now when you're swimming, that's like a once return. You are halfway, you know, even over halfway. You're only going to have one more return here. That's a once returner. And then you get so close to the shore, you don't need to swim, you can stand up and walk the rest of the distance. That's the non-returner. And then you're sitting under a coconut tree on dry land, having a cup of tea with condensed milk from Sri Lanka. Then that's not what the Buddha said, sorry, I made that up. You're safe. That's the arahat. You've made it to dry land. So the difference between a stream winner, you can see dry land, but you haven't got there yet, and the arahat, you've got there. You've made it to the shore. Next question. Dear Sangha brother, it feels very comfortable walking on the clean floor. May you be enlightened one day, serve more and more sentient beings. Thank you. Serve them with what? Serve them with tea and condensed milk? Yeah, am I supposed to be working in a shop, being a waiter? They said you should serve more and more sentient beings. Anyway, it feels comfortable walking on the clean floor. Exactly. Why not? Dear Ajahn Brahm, I find it difficult getting up at 4 to 4:30, especially with gusto. Is there any advantage to meditating early on? Okay. If you can't get up at 4 to 4:30, get up at 3. Give you a choice. Come on. What's wrong with getting up at 4:30 or 4 o'clock? So what you can do is put your clock 2 hours forward. So instead of, what time is it now? It's maybe 9:20. Put your clock to 11:22 and set your alarm clock to getting up at 6 o'clock. And then you look at, 6 o'clock, time to get up. It's all in the head, all in the mind. It doesn't matter what time you get up. But, you know, 4 o'clock is really cool. It's the hot weather now. And you have a nice sleep, you get up, it's cool, it's fresh. You've had a sleep, your mind is really good. And it is true. You know, I've been a monk a long time. Most people get enlightened, you know, just about sunrise or dawn. And if you, that's about 5 o'clock now, I think. So if you don't get up till 5:30, you've missed your chance. You know, so please, at least once get up before dawn, to give it a go. This may be your dawn. And if you keep sleeping through it every day in your life, there's no hope for you. My brother-in-law's wife is pregnant 3 months, and doctor found the body abnormal. Maybe we'll be born no hand or eyes, and even she born, she only can stand a while. So they decide to do abortion. Is it bad karma? It's bad karma if you have bad intention. So it's not what you do, it's why you do it. Like the whole of the meditation, it's not what you're aware of, it's not how you are aware. The whole of life is not exactly what you do, but why you do it, how you do it. So if you really do that, you know, because you really sincerely believe that's the best you can possibly do, the most compassionate thing you can possibly do, then that is not bad karma. It depends why you do it. If you do that because, you know, you don't want to have that baby, or you're fed up with it, you don't want to put forth the effort or something selfish or with negativity, then of course that's bad karma. But if it really is your idea of compassion, you've done the research, that baby's going to have a bad life, then of course it's not bad karma. Abortion isn't always bad karma. An example of that, what the example which I've quoted many, many times, and it was a great story. I was visiting my mother in London many years ago. She was watching the news, and so I sat with her, and there was a news item about a mother. She was in one of the hospitals in Wales. She was pregnant with twins, and the doctors, they'd all agreed there was no doubt in the prognosis. If she just went ahead with that birth of twins, both twins would die and so would she. I forget what the condition was, I wasn't a doctor. But if they aborted one of those twins, the other one would survive and so would the mother. And so it became an ethical debate, and all these Christians come in, no, leave it up to God, you shouldn't do anything. Now, I thought that is really wrong. Now, if you abort one child, the other one will live, and so will the mother. And it was so sure, there was no doubt at all in people's minds, that was what would happen. Now, as it happened, while everyone was debating it, the doctor performed the abortion. And that was the end of the ethical debate. And I asked you, if you were that doctor and you had the duty of care, it was your decision, you couldn't put it off to anybody else, what would you do as a Buddhist? Because you really have a choice. Doing the abortion means two people live. Not doing it, and not doing it is action too. It's reprehensible. It's bad karma. It is something you can do and you don't do it. And if you just don't do anything, then three people die. Which is the worst? And I told people, if I was that doctor, I would have done that abortion. Would you? I think most of you would say yes. When I've asked that question, asked for a show of hands, 90% of Buddhists put their hands up, yeah, they would do that. They are wise, they are compassionate, they're doing it for the right reason. They're not doing it to end the life of one of those people in the womb. Their main intention is to save the life of the other two. If you're clear with your intentions, you understand what you're doing and why it is good karma. Would you do that? Hopefully you're clear enough about the law of karma that yes, hopefully you would do that. Now the next question, which often comes up, I'll just mention this because it's a practical one. That will probably very rarely, and also number two, is on abortion. Many of you have had abortions, you women, and people have come up to me and they feel so guilty when they've had an abortion. And I tell them, I apologize on behalf of men. Because you're told abortions are wrong, are evil, are a sin. Mostly by men who have never got pregnant, mostly by men who don't get married, by priests and by popes and by monks. And we have no right to do that to you, to make you feel guilty. It's bad enough as it is making that choice and decision to abort without men coming up and saying, bad girl. And I apologize for that sincerely. We're laying more pain on pain. It's bad enough to do that, having to make that choice. And it's for the people I've met who have had abortions, I've talked to them, tried to empathize with them. It's never a decision made easily. You agonize over that decision. And you do it because there's no choice, usually. And so the job of a man, especially a religious man like me, is never ever to criticize you. Never ever to make you feel more in pain. It's your decision, or whichever way you go, the job of men is to support you, never to criticize you. One reason, because we'll never understand, we've never been through that situation. We never had to make that choice. So we have got no right to judge. And we should butt out of judging women for having abortions. That's number one. And number two, to be there beforehand, be there afterwards. And to try and encourage you, it's not bad karma. Very, very rare is it bad karma. You're making the best choice you possibly can. It's not easy. And I've never met a woman who's taken that lightly. If the intention is reasonably pure, well done. if they've made the right decision. And if that baby, this particular baby over here, oh, that's not that one. If that particular baby over there, you know, he's not going to have a good quality of life, and you're doing it for that reason, there's a very, very good chance that baby will come back again, usually into your life, and have another go. I know this might seem a bit sort of trite, but it is not that different. Trying to get a simile from real life. When you go to the airport and you're booked into some cheap flight, and you go there and say, sorry, we've overbooked, you're bumped off the flight, you can't, you know, take off on this flight. What happens if you've ever, I've never had that, but if you've been bumped off a flight, what they usually do is they offer you the next flight and upgrade you, business class. And that's pretty much what happens to a kid like that. They don't quite make it, you know, through into this life. So they get the next available womb and an upgrade also. That's basically what happens. So you're not denying them a life. They just have another try, and next time they get a much, much better sort of seat. They're not so deformed or whatever. So it's not really that bad for the kid also, if you understand in Buddhism what happens. So anyway, that's with abortion. So please, you know, you have my support, and hopefully the support of other Buddhist leaders, men, who, you know, we should have some women leaders soon. So come on, you two, you know, get older quickly. So you can also sort of, you know, lead and inspire people. So there we go. Those are the questions for tonight. It's gone on a bit, 9:30. I do apologize for that, but they're important questions. No many in it, so please, one question each for tomorrow. And now, three sadhus. Ready? Get the energy coming up. Come and build it up. Yes! Sadhu!